Lecture 5, Conspiracy Insanity. When I was in college, my roommate and I attended a tax seminar in which we were told that paying taxes was unnecessary because the 16th Amendment, which empowered Congress to levy an income tax, was never legally ratified. After a long and detailed history of the IRS, we were advised not to file a tax return and given instructions on what to do and say when the feds come a-knockin'. This was a type of conspiracy theory inasmuch as it involved a government agency illegally profiting from citizens without their knowledge, and the slick presentation seemed internally coherent and logically plausible while I was sitting there in the room. It was not until later, after some reflection, that I figured it couldn't possibly be true because, if it were, no one would pay taxes. Unfortunately, my roommate went for it and got away tax-free for years until the IRS caught up with him and he got his comeuppance. I was thinking about this incident in August 2013 when I appeared as an expert witness in the case of the United States of America versus Miles J. Julison, a house flipper who lost big in the 2007 financial meltdown. That year, he reported $583,151 in other income to the IRS on his tax return, claiming that the entire amount was withheld as income taxes. Submitting 8 IRS 1099 OID forms, Julison requested a refund of $411,773. According to the IRS, an OID, or original issue discount, is a form of interest. It is the excess of a debt instrument's stated redemption price at maturity over its issue price. A 1099 OID applies to debt instruments such as bonds and notes that were discounted at purchase. The tax is the difference between the instrument's actual value and the discounted purchase price. 1099 OID fraud consists of filing Form 1099 OID with false withholding information to reduce taxable income. Amazingly, the IRS sent Julison a check in that amount of $411,773, which he spent on a home loan, credit card bills, a Mercedes-Benz, and a boat. Emboldened by his success, the next year, Julison reported $2.3 million in income and demanded a refund of $1.5 million. This time, however, instead of a refund check, he got an IRS investigation that took him to court and, after a guilty verdict, landed him in jail. This particular tax scam is popular among tax resistors with a conspiratorial bent, especially those who call themselves sovereign citizens, who hold that the United States government is actually a corporation owned by the International Monetary Fund and English banks, and that there is a secret account bearing $1 million for every child born in the U.S., thereby rendering them slaves to a global financial system. Sovereign citizens believe that this money should be refunded to them, and the 1099 OID is one tool among many that they use. Sovereign citizens believe that they are exempt from federal jurisdiction because they are natural citizens who received their rights from God instead of what they call 14th Amendment citizens, slaves who were freed by this constitutional amendment who have fewer rights. As such, sovereign citizens do not believe that they are subject to federal jurisdiction. They don't recognize government currency. Gold is popular among such far-right groups. And, of course, they do not accept the legitimacy of taxation. Many do not believe in federal laws, and some even post sovereign land signs on their lawns, explaining that trespassers, including law enforcement agents, would be committing an act of war. The FBI labels them a domestic terrorist threat, and the Southern Poverty Law Center estimates that there are about 100,000 hardcore sovereign believers. As a self-proclaimed sovereign citizen, Miles Julison did not recognize the court's right to try him, declined to represent himself, and refused to work with his court-appointed lawyer, the attorney that brought me in on the case, who repeatedly urged him to plead guilty for a reduced sentence in the face of overwhelming evidence against him, if for no other reason than that he had a wife and two children who needed him. Instead, as it shows in the court records and as I heard him repeatedly say in court, Julison kept repeating variants on the following. For and on the record, I am here under express duress in propria persona. I am Miles Joseph, creation of Christ Jesus. I reserve all of my unalienable rights without prejudice, UCC 1-308, Declaration of Independence, Nunc pro Tunc, Praetoria Praetoria, and without the state. My jurisdiction is in harmony with the common law, UCC 1-103. I refuse for cause all testimony of this court, as it is not under penalty of perjury, 28 U.S.C. 7146, Clause 1. My silence does not preclude a contract whatsoever. UCC is the Universal Commercial Code enacted into law in 1952 to govern business transactions and to standardize U.S. business law so that it is uniform in every state. Julison repeated this language and these codes as if they were talismans, magical objects that would work if repeated in just the right sequence to set him free. During a lunch break outside the courtroom, Julison happened to walk past me, so I took the opportunity to ask him if he really believes all these sovereign citizen claims, or if he was just in it for the money. As my testimony was done and I was heading home, I hoped for honesty. He was as unequivocal in his conviction as he was adamant in his mannerisms, as he told me, "The United States is a corporation in the state of Delaware. I have their registration papers printed right off their website. Before anything can be argued, there has to be a jurisdiction established." "So my description of you as a true believer is true?" I inquired, referencing my own testimony in court that I did not think he was just a con man pretending to be a sovereign citizen. "I believe in the blood of the Lamb," Julison responded, biblically. The sovereign citizen movement is but a recent instantiation of larger and older conspiracy theories, in this case an American right-wing populist movement known as the Posse Comitatus. There is a federal law, the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, that authorizes officials to use the military to ensure domestic order. But among conspiracists, the phrase Posse Comitatus is more associated with the spontaneous formation of a citizen's posse to suppress lawlessness. Think of a Wild West posse riding out to track a lawless gunslinger. In the 1960s, a ragtag group of citizens, calling themselves Posse Comitatus, practiced survivalism and fueled the rise of the militia movement in the 1990s, following government overreach at Ruby Ridge and Waco. The Posse Comitatus conspiracy theory holds that the county, not the country, is the highest level of legitimate government, and that county sheriffs are the highest-ranking law enforcement agents. This leads members not only to refuse to pay federal and state taxes, but to reject government-issued licenses, issue bogus legal and financial documents, and concoct elaborate conspiracy theories involving the gold standard, the Federal Reserve, and international bankers. Posse Comitatus, in turn, is associated with the white supremacist Christian Identity movement, whose stated mission was well captured by the posse's primary founder, William Potter Gale. "This nation," said Gale, "was founded by white men and white women who were Christians. They fought their way across the wilderness and built a great nation. In the name of the God of our fathers, this nation will remain a white man's land and a white man's government. As part and parcel of their conspiracy thinking, members of the Sovereign Citizens, Posse Comitatus, and Christian Identity movements do not recognize law enforcement as legitimate. The result of these beliefs turned deadly in West Memphis, Arkansas, on May 20, 2010, when Sovereign Citizen Jerry Kane was pulled over by two state police officers for a routine traffic stop. As he engaged in fisticuffs with the police, Kane's 16-year-old son leaped out of the vehicle with his father's AK-47 rifle and shot dead both cops. Father and son were subsequently chased down in a Walmart parking lot and killed by the police. Worse, some of these conspiracists consider federal buildings to be bases of a Jewish enemy government, sometimes rendered as ZOG, Zionist Occupation Government. And so it should come as no surprise that Christian Identity Movement member Terry Nichols aided and abetted Timothy McVeigh in blowing up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. Belief in conspiracy theories can be murderous. How does someone come to believe in such a conspiracy theory? I attempted to answer this question in another court case that was similar to Miles Julison's, this one involving a scheme claiming that paying income tax is voluntary. Among the dozens of documents and videotaped lectures I reviewed in this case was one from a tax consultant who told his audience, filing of a U.S. individual income tax return form 1040 is completely voluntary. A person working in the private sector is not required to file or pay income taxes because there is no provision in the Internal Revenue Code which specifically and unequivocally requires an individual to pay income taxes. One citizen of Hawaii who bought this line volunteered not to pay income tax for many years and accumulated a debt of $4,527,614. The case was ultimately settled out of court with the IRS, whom I presume got their money, with interest and penalties. For the record, paying income tax is not voluntary. For this case, I was tasked by the defense to put together a primer on belief, 10 components that explain precisely how and why someone can come to believe a conspiracy theory. Here are the 10 components of belief. 1. The brain is a belief engine. As many studies have shown, the brain generates beliefs naturally, whereas skepticism and doubt are unnatural, uncomfortable, and even painful. Recall the study we considered in an earlier lecture conducted by Sam Harris and his colleagues at UCLA. In it, they presented their subjects with a series of statements designed to be plainly true, clearly false, or undecidable. In response, the volunteers were to press a button indicating belief, disbelief, or uncertainty. For example, true, most people have 10 fingers and 10 toes. False, eagles are common pets. Uncertain, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.2% last Tuesday. Evaluating brain scans taken as the participants reacted to the statements, the researchers made three important discoveries. 1. There were significant reaction time differences in evaluating statements. Responses to true belief statements were significantly shorter than responses to both false disbelief statements and uncertain statements. 2. The reaction time to true belief statements involved a spike in neural activity in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, an area of the brain associated with learning in the context of rewards. And 3, the reaction to false disbelief statements showed increased brain activity in the anterior insula associated with responses to negative stimuli, pain perception, and disgust. Application. Just hearing and comprehending a conspiracy theory leads to tacit acceptance of it as true. rejecting it as false or undecidable takes more time and is uncomfortable or unpleasant to do. The second component of belief can be summarized this way. Beliefs are reinforced by authorities. We are a hierarchical social species who look up to authorities for guidance, starting with our parents, which is wise when you are young and inexperienced. We feel a sense of duty or obligation to people in positions of authority. This is why advertisers of pharmaceutical products employ doctors to front their campaigns, and why most of us will do most things that our manager requests. Job titles, uniforms, and even accessories like cars or gadgets can lend an air of authority and can persuade us to accept what these people say. Obedience to authority was the basis for the famous shock experiments conducted by psychologist Stanley Milgram at Yale University in an attempt to understand how ordinarily good Germans became extraordinarily evil Nazis. Obviously, Milgram could not have his experimental subjects gas or shoot people, so he chose electric shock as a legal, non-lethal substitute. Looking for subjects to participate in what was billed as a study of memory, Milgram advertised on the Yale campus and also in the surrounding New Haven community. He said he wanted factory workers, city employees, laborers, barbers, businessmen, clerks, construction workers, salespeople, telephone workers, and not just the usual guinea pigs of the science lab, in other words, undergraduates. Milgram then assigned his subjects to the role of teacher in what was purported to be research on the effects of punishment on learning. The protocol called for the teacher to read a list of paired words to the learner, who was in reality a shill working for Milgram, then present the first word of each pair again, upon which the learner was to recall the second word. Each time that the learner was incorrect, the teacher was to deliver an electric shock from a box with toggle switches in 15-volt increments that ranged from 15 volts all the way to 450 volts, and featured labels ranging from slight shock all the way to danger, severe shock. In reality, there were no shocks, but the learner reacted as though experiencing varying degrees of pain. So for the teacher, it seemed to be very real indeed. Despite the predictions of 40 psychiatrists that Milgram surveyed before the experiment, who figured that only 1% of subjects would go all the way to the end, 65% of them completed the experiment, flipping that final toggle switch to deliver a shocking 450 volts, all because the authority in the form of an experimenter ordered them to do so. A phenomenon the social psychologist Philip Zimbardo characterizes as the pornography of power. Who is most likely to go the distance in maximal shock delivery? Surprisingly and counterintuitively, gender, age, occupation, and personality characteristics mattered little to the outcome. Similar levels of punishment were delivered by the young and the old, by men and women, by blue-collar and white-collar workers alike. Application. If a college psychologist can get ordinary people to deliver deadly shocks to innocent people by merely emphasizing the authority of the person giving the orders, how much easier must it be for a cult leader or conspiracy theorist to convince people of the validity of their claim if delivered in an authoritative manner? The third component of belief is that beliefs are reinforced by peers. This component, also known as the principle of social proof, relies on people's sense of safety in numbers. For example, we're more likely to work late if others in our team are doing the same, or put a tip in a jar if it already contains money, or eat in a restaurant if it's busy. Here, we're assuming that if lots of other people are doing something, then it must be okay. We're particularly susceptible to this principle when we're feeling uncertain, and we're even more likely to be influenced if the people we see seem to be similar to us. That's why commercials often use moms, not celebrities, to advertise household products, and TV shows use canned laughter. Social proof is a shortcut to knowledge possessed by others. We make fewer mistakes by acting in accord with social evidence than by acting contrary to it. Like poll the audience on the TV game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? For simple tasks such as guessing the number of jelly beans in a jar, a decent-sized audience will average a guess within a couple percentage points of the correct answer. Application. Conspiracy theories are often conveyed in groups of people, either in person in a hotel conference room or online in chat rooms. There's a sense of camaraderie among the members that provides social proof that the claims have some validity to them. Moving to the fourth component of belief, we can observe that beliefs are reinforced by liking and the similarity of other beliefs. We're more likely to be influenced by people we like. Likeability comes in many forms. People might be similar or familiar to us, they might give us compliments, or we may just simply trust them. Companies that use sales agents from within the community employ this principle with huge success. People are more likely to buy from people like themselves, from friends, and from people they know and respect. Application. Conspiracy theories often play up the similarities among group members, particularly in contrast to some other group, usually a government agency or corporation or evil clan, that wants to harm our good group. And here's the fifth component of belief. Beliefs are reinforced by payoff, success, and happiness. The group you join helps you quit your addiction, break your bad habits, fix your marriage, find a job, etc. By definition, a reinforcement is anything that causes someone to repeat a behavior. And as B.F. Skinner showed in his classic experiments, all of us are motivated to seek rewards and to avoid punishments. So anything that reinforces a behavior related to a belief only strengthens that belief. Application. Conspiracy theories, particularly those of a financial sort, promise believers that they will be rewarded for accepting the conspiracy theory as real, either directly through financial reward or indirectly through the reinforcement of inside knowledge and secret powers to come. The sixth component of belief is something we've mentioned before. Beliefs are reinforced by the confirmation bias. Recall that the confirmation bias is the tendency to seek and find confirming evidence in support of already existing beliefs and ignore or reinterpret disconfirming evidence. We remember the hits and forget the misses. Social psychologist Jeffrey Cohen, for example, conducted a study in which he discovered that Democrats are more accepting of a welfare program if they believe it was proposed by a fellow Democrat, even when in fact the proposal comes from a Republican and is quite restrictive. Predictably, Cohen found the same effect for Republicans, who were far more likely to approve of a generous welfare program if they thought it was proposed by a fellow Republican. In other words, even when examining the exact same data, people from both parties arrive at radically different conclusions. Application. Conspiracy theories are the very embodiment of the confirmation bias, directing believers to look for and find evidence that confirms the conspiracy theory and ignore or rationalize away evidence that disconfirms the conspiracy theory. The seventh component of belief can be stated this way. Beliefs are reinforced by the optimism and over-optimism bias. The optimism bias is the tendency to see oneself as better than average, and as more likely to succeed than the odds warrant. According to the psychologist Daniel Kahneman, people tend to be overly optimistic about their relative standing on any activity in which they do moderately well. Research shows, for example, that chief financial officers, CFOs, were grossly overconfident about their ability to forecast the market. In fact, Duke University researchers collected 11,600 CFO forecasts and matched them to market outcomes and found a correlation of less than zero. And this overconfidence can be costly. The study of CFOs showed that those who were most confident and optimistic about the S&P 500 index were also overconfident and optimistic about the prospects of their own firm, which went on to take more risk than others. As Kahneman explains, one of the benefits of an optimistic temperament is that it encourages persistence in the face of obstacles. But a pervasive optimistic bias can be detrimental. Most of us view the world as more benign than it really is, our own attributes as more favorable than they truly are, and the goals we adopt as more achievable than they are likely to be. Application. Conspiracy theories fuel the optimism bias and usually tip it into over-optimism, to the point where reality is distorted. Who in their right mind, for example, would believe that paying taxes is purely voluntary? Over-optimistic conspiracists, that's who. The eighth component of belief deals with another bias. Beliefs are reinforced by the self-justification bias. The self-justification bias is the tendency to rationalize decisions after the fact to convince ourselves that what we did was the best thing we could have done. Once we make a decision about something in our lives, we carefully screen subsequent data and filter out all contradictory information related to that decision, leaving only evidence in support of the choice we made. This bias applies to everything from career and job choices to mundane purchases. One of the practical benefits of self-justification is that no matter what decision we make, to take this or that job, to marry this or that person, to purchase this or that product, we will almost always be satisfied with the decision, even when the objective evidence is to the contrary. The political scientist Philip Tetlock, for example, has reviewed the evidence for the ability of professional experts in politics and economics to make accurate predictions. And what Tetlock finds is that even though all these experts claim to have data in support of their predictions and assessments, it turns out that when analyzed after the fact, such expert opinions and predictions turn out to be no better than those of non-experts or even chance. Yet, as the self-justification bias would predict, experts are significantly less likely to admit that they are wrong than non-experts. Or as I like to say, smart people believe weird things because they're better at rationalizing the beliefs that they hold for non-smart reasons. Application. Conspiracy theories traffic in self-justification, and proponents of conspiracy theories almost always consider themselves experts. Belief component number 9 goes like this. Beliefs are reinforced by the sunk cost bias. The sunk cost bias is the tendency to believe in something because of the cost sunk into that belief. We hang on to losing stocks, unprofitable investments, failing businesses, and unsuccessful relationships. And we concoct reasons that seem rational to justify those beliefs and behaviors in which we have made sizable investments. Application. Conspiracy theories depend heavily on maintaining their membership roles by getting people to commit to the theory, and the more they sink into that belief, the harder it is to let it go, whether it is financial commitment or psychological investment. And finally, here's the 10th component of belief. Beliefs are reinforced by the endowment effect. The psychology underlying the sunk cost bias is what the economist Richard Thaler calls the endowment effect, or the tendency to value what we own more than what we do not own. In his research on the endowment effect, Thaler has found that owners of an item value it roughly twice as much as potential buyers of the same item. In one experiment, subjects were given a coffee mug valued at $6, and they were asked what they would take for it. The average price below which they would not sell was $5.25. Another group of subjects were asked how much they would be willing to pay for the same mug that they did not own and gave an average price of $2.75. Ownership endows value by its own virtue, and nature has endowed us to hold dear what is ours. Application. Conspiracy theories are further reinforced by endowing believers with secret knowledge that they believe gives them power that they would not otherwise have. And with power comes confidence, then overconfidence. In this lecture, we have looked at how belief in a conspiracy theory can be personally harmful. From financial loss to alienation from family and friends to jail time to violent, even deadly confrontations, buying into a conspiracy theory comes with a long list of risks. But we can mitigate those risks, both to ourselves and others, by thinking critically about the psychological tendencies and biases that reinforce our beliefs. The 10 components of belief that I've outlined give us a structure for understanding how people get tangled in the net of conspiracy theories. But they can also help us step back and evaluate some of our own most cherished notions.